It is now 3:37, and we will officially start the meeting. And I'd like to start off by, you know, thanking everyone for being here, one, and two, being so prompt. It really makes it easier. We have a full agenda, so I would like to start off agenda. Let me share my screen. Sorry, so I know some of you like to see the, let's see. Oh, what else? Okay, here we go. Okay, and I'd like to start off by asking for a motion for the approval of the agenda. But before I do so, I'd like to make one edit. Item number 7A, and the spelling of Dr. Flowers' first name is D-E-I-D-R-E. So if we could just make that one edit, and then I would like to have a motion to approve the agenda as amended.
Motion to approve the agenda. Now is the time for people who want to add to it to make a motion to add.
Thank you. Could I propose a motion to add an item about land acknowledgements under new business? It's a question, really. But...
Was that L-A-N-D?
Yes.
And that was land acknowledgements?
Yes, please.
And that's 7B.
Ask if there's any objection to the addition.
Are there any objections to adding land acknowledgements as a new business item 7B? And because my screen is sort of minimized, can I be reminded who's making that request just because?
Yeah, I'm James Lowry. It's okay. L-O-W-R-Y, Queen's College.
Yeah, I just can't see you, but thank you. Seeing none, motion to approve?
Move to approve the agenda as amended.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposition? Abstentions? Thank you. So moved. Item number 2, approval of the academic senate meeting minutes dated October 8th. Before I call for an approval, I would like to make one amendment again in spelling. Page 5, Dr. Lee, chair of the Graduate Curriculum Committee, the spelling of her last name is L-I, not L-E-E.
Move to approve the minutes.
Move to approve?
Yes.
As amended.
As amended.
Second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Objections. Abstentions. Thank you. I'm going to stop share, and then I'm going to go to announcements and start off with item 3A, QC Navigate, and that's Dr. Littleman and Dean of Institutional Effectiveness. And Dr. Fernandez, Associate Provost for Innovation and Student Success. I would like to ask everyone if they could put themselves on mute during this presentation and take it away. Thank you.
Thank you. I think I'm unmuted and I believe that you can see my screen. I'm Eva Fernandez. I'm the Associate Provost for Innovation and Student Success at Queen's College. And my co-presenter is Cheryl Littman. Cheryl, would you like to say hello?
Sure, thanks. Good afternoon, everybody. Cheryl Littman from the Office of Institutional Effectiveness. Nice to see you, and thanks for having us today.
So we really appreciate your giving us some time to talk to you about a project that Cheryl and I have been spending a little time on over the past couple of years. This is a piece of software that we actually advocated for getting to campus many years ago, and we're excited that it's here. It's been around for a little bit, and we have some, we wanted to give you an overview of what it does and see if we can get your interest in in joining us in using the product, although it's really not about the product, it's about what we're doing to improve student retention, student time to graduation, student grades and courses, et cetera. So QC Navigate is just a tool that is part of a much bigger student support network that starts with every classroom, that includes every support office, every one of you, including students, because it turns out that students play a very important role in student success too. So today's presentation, we'll show you what Navigate is, we'll tell you a little bit about who's using it, what we're learning, and we'll ask you for thoughts about where we should go from here and how the Senate would like to engage with us. I understand that Cheryl's keeping an eye on the chat, which is good because I don't think I can see it on my little screen. So let's take it away. Navigate is actually, it's a platform that has two linked components. One of them is focused on anyone who advises students, that's faculty, advisors, peer tutors, et cetera. And it gives you tools for sending messages through email or text, running appointment campaigns. That is, I want to see all the students in my major and they need to make appointments with me between November 15th and December 15th. I can do that very easily with Navigate. It is designed to manage cases. So if a student has an issue, brings it up with their advisor, Navigate can track all of the touch points for that student as we administer the various kinds of responses of what the next steps might be for the student. And I'll tell you a little bit later about some early alert stuff that we're experimenting with Navigate staff. There's also advanced tools that we're using a little bit less so far, but we're beginning to see some really interesting ways that Navigate lets us track groups of students and interventions. And it has historical and current data that can help us guide decision-making and guide advising suggestions, including some predictive analytics that are not yet fully part of the system, but are coming soon. So that's the Navigate staff side of things. There's also a student app, and it's for students undergraduate or graduate, and we'll show you the functions in a minute, so I don't think I'm gonna read through the bullet list. Actually, here it is. So here's a few snapshots of what Navigate Student looks like. You download it on your phone, you log in using your CUNY ID, so the same way that you log into CUNY First. The very first thing that the app asks you to do is to answer a survey, which you re-answer every semester. And this helps us identify what kind of communication we should be sending to you. So if you're interested in career options, you know that the Career Center is going to be pushing messages to you. The app itself shows you the courses that you're taking, and this updates nightly with refreshes. So if you drop your Korean class and decide to take Spanish instead, which for me would probably be a very good idea, I'd do better in the Spanish class. But the app will show me the following day as CUNY First refreshes the data. So this is fresh data every day about what you're doing as a student. Other functionalities, there is a major explorer function in Navigate Student where you answer a few questions and the app will make suggestions about the kinds of majors that you might want to consider. So if I'm majoring in elementary education, but I'm very interested in coding, I answer a couple of questions and the app might suggest to me the design major or something related that I should be thinking about. The app has a study buddies function where you can look in your classes to see if anybody is looking for a fellow student to study with. And then there's a lot of information that we can post on QC Navigate deadlines, to-do items, tips and tricks for getting ahead and doing better as a student. So that is the student app. We have some stats regarding who's using it. And we have had, since we launched the app in March, 10,000 students have actually downloaded or accessed the app on a web browser. And what we find really encouraging is that 64% of them are return users. So that's pretty good as far as I can tell. It's not just like, you know, you download the app because your advisor tells you to in order to make an appointment with them. It seems that students find some value. They're using the intake survey. Some of them are looking for study buddies, and we've listed there the classes that have the biggest hits in terms of students looking for other study buddies. There are to-dos that we send them. For example, get familiar with the academic integrity policy is one of the to-dos, and that one has been checked off. We can track who's checked it and who's seen it but hasn't done anything with it. And then the program explorer is that exploring other majors, and we've had a couple thousand students respond to that. The application, as students engage with all of these components, it gathers data that then it pushes all over to navigate staff so that faculty advisors can then use that data to take action. So for instance, if I'm interested in recruiting students who have an interest in the outdoors and in art, because I have an internship program or I have a scholarship opportunity, or because I think that they'd be great students in my major, I can message them using information that they've provided to us through the student app. So that's Navigate Student. Let's take a quick look at Navigate Staff. And Navigate Staff, again, this is available if you're teaching a class. This semester, you have access as a professor. If you have any kind of advising role in your department, and in fact, all full-time faculty have additionally staff access to the tool. So the first thing to notice is that when you log in and you look up a student, you get rich information about the student that pulls data from various parts of CUNY First and puts it all in just a couple of screens, and also pulls information from the student app, as I mentioned before. And in addition, it's actionable information. That is, you can use this interface from a student profile to send an email or a text to a student right from right there, and to make notes about an interaction that you might have had with a student that you want to make sure that some other office is aware that transaction happened. One thing that happened earlier this semester, or was it over the summer? Gosh, I forget. Time doesn't go the same way as it did before March. We managed to get student photos in the app so that now you can actually see what your students look like. I know that in the screenshot that you have, we covered the actual photo. We wanted to protect the student's identity, but log in and see. The next screen, I believe, shows us a little bit more in depth the kinds of information that Navigate staff gives you about students, with GPA information, what majors and minors the students have. And if you click around the various screens, one of my favorite ones is class info. I don't have a picture of it, but you should log in if you're a professor and look up one of your students. You get to see the whole class history of your of the student that you're looking at. So you can see what they've been up to and sort of contextualize your interactions with them. These are some screens that I'm sure are way too small for anybody to see, but I wanted you to know that this is there. So there's predictive analytics I mentioned is coming. There's some sophisticated reporting functions that Navigate has. What's on the screen is one of the reports that I like the most, because it gives you the ability to look in a snapshot at what's going on with either the whole student population, so all 20,000 students, or maybe just students in your major. You can see their average GPA, you can see how many credits on average they've completed. Those histograms that you can see are things like, well, how many students and what GPA bin do we have in this, in the whole school or just in a particular major? And it's really easy and user-friendly to explore what's the difference between, say, computer science and design students, or, you know, are the linguists having a higher GPA than, I don't know, non-linguists. So that's one of the reports to show you. Another one to kind of, again, I don't expect anybody to be able to see this, but I'll describe what this functionality gives us in QC Navigate. If you've ever run a program and you're interested in, well, if I have students participate in some, I don't know, summer internship program, and I want to know what impact that has on them in terms of retention and time to graduation over time, for example, and I want to compare them to some other population, or I just want to look at them themselves, Navigate gives you the tools to do that on your own without having to request the data from Cheryl Littman's office, maximizing a lot of people's time and actually making it very easy to get some pretty sophisticated data. Like in this case, we're comparing QC Enforced students who entered in fall 2017 to all other students who entered that fall and were freshmen or sophomores. And we see that the QC Enforced students are 93% all still enrolled, and many of them are set to graduate compared to the comparison group, which is only 70% still enrolled and has a lower GPA and is less on track to graduate. So that's the kind of really sophisticated reporting we get. Again, we're looking at a tool here that is really amplifying the way that we do work around understanding academic momentum and how we can advance academic momentum, how we can reduce achievement gaps, how we can improve retention and graduation. Just a couple more slides, if you'll bear with me. This is where it gets really exciting. We launched the software in February, and as you know, everybody knows what happened in March. And we were concerned that the whole project might die. But in fact, what happened is that Navigate has made it really easy for us to communicate with students. And what you see on the screen is emails and SMS messages that we've been sending using Navigate. I say we, but I really mean a whole lot of different people around the campus. Between March 1st and November 7th. Really interesting to note, you know, those peaks are times that we did mass communications to students around, ooh, it's a few weeks into the pandemic, or the semester is about to end. Are you ready for your exams? What's interesting is that if you take out some of the mass emails that we did through Navigate, there's still those same peaks, meaning that different offices are engaged in communicating with students at these different times. So we now have a way of capturing when it is that we're talking to students and tracking to see whether maybe it's better, if you want a really impactful message, send it during the Valley week when nobody else is sending messages, because the students' inboxes will be less cluttered. We are tracking the appointments that people are making using Navigate. And I think I forgot to tell you that one of the main functions of the student app is actually that it makes it really easy to make appointments with advisors. So again, we thought that as the pandemic hit, nobody would be making appointments using Navigate, but that is entirely wrong. In fact, we see an upward moving trend with the peaks and valleys that we would expect given who the main users are, and that's academic advising and SEEK. And Laura, if you're in the room, kudos to you, and Norca and anyone from SEEK if they're in the room. We know that the walk-in appointments are mostly SEEK advisors. And again, we're seeing really good stats in that we don't have that many no-shows or cancellations. They wind up being a pretty small percentage of what we've got. I believe, yeah, so which departments are using and how many appointments, so that's on this slide. Again, advising and SEEK are the main players. Psychology, Claudia, I think that I saw you, Claudia Brumbau, amazing numbers coming from psychology, knowing that you all just started to use it just a few months ago. We expect more and more departments to get their feet wet with how to use this. And what we're hearing in the early reports of adopters is that, well, it's really relatively easy to just sync my calendar and make appointments with students. And last thing to show you, we launched alerts and cases earlier this semester. I think on September 29th, we opened up alerts for faculty to be able to basically send us a signal that someone in their class is in trouble. And I wonder if any of you have used it as faculty, and if there's any students, if you've received one of these messages saying somebody submitted an alert about you. We're trying to understand what the impact is of these alerts. We believe that this is one way that we can help catch students who are in trouble and either make them notice that their professor is noticing. So even if they don't get back to us, they get back to you. And if not, we're able to point them in the right direction. We're hoping that eventually more than just a handful of places will have associated alerts, but rather that we'll be able to use this as a way that a professor or an advisor for a student can direct resources for the student college-wide. Where I think that some of the traffic in the alerts that we're seeing this semester was also propagated by athletics recently turning to QC Navigate for a progress report activity. Athletics, back in the old days, right, I would occasionally get a paper from athletics where I would need to fill out that a student in my class was an athlete and I needed to say how they're doing. Well, we can do this all electronically. We had been using Hobson's in recent years, but this is the new tool for the college. We've learned a lot, and I apologize for showing you so many graphs. I think that we posted the slides on a public website. I'll tell you where to find it in a moment. We've learned that it's challenging, but it's incredibly important to work cross-departmentally to support students. As I think I mentioned before, faculty and staff are in general reporting relative ease of use. This is not CUNY first. It's a lot snappier and easier. And you can even figure out a lot of the functionality on your own. Navigate was a really instrumental tool in helping with the transition to online and in terms of providing support to students in a really broad and deep way. And we've discovered that students are definitely hungry for that interaction and collaboration that tools like this can give them. I'm still really surprised at how much interest there is in the Study Buddies feature, and we really need to dig into how to help people find that. And one last thing is that we're really, we're becoming part of telling this story of student success, not just within Queens College, but talking to other colleagues around CUNY and also at the national level. The company that runs Navigate is an organization called EAB, and they actually have been in the business of publicizing and investigating best practices around student success for a while. So now we're part of that network, and I think that that will only make us stronger and bring better practices to Queens College. So that's it. Some questions for you on this final slide. If you are a faculty member, you serve as an advisor to students, go check out the implementation site and log into the live site and see what it is. If you're a student, go to the App Store or Google Play and download the application. And that's all we have.
Thank you. Do we have any questions? I think we can take one or two questions if there are any pressing questions.
And I have a question.
And inform that we will be sharing these slides with you and we'll make them a part of the agenda minutes.
Can I ask the question?
Yes.
Yes.
Did you say that the professors could see the students' GPA?
Yes. So there's all sorts of academic information about a student in the in student profiles.
So how does this not violate FERPA?
So good question. In CUNY First, you would also have access to this information. The GPA is information that's important for you to understand as a person that's providing support to a student.
Right. But how does it not violate PREP? Doesn't student have to give permission to see their GPA?
No. Hi, this is Richard Alvarez, if I could jump in. And this is a tool that's being implemented by the university. And it is a way to supplement what information is in CUNY First. So as Eva mentioned, the goal is to provide the advisors who have this information already. So the information in Navigate is no different than the information and the roles that a faculty advisor would have in CUNY First.
Oh, I thought you said that a professor could see this, not a faculty advisor.
Well, they're both. Faculty who are advisors.
Can I see my student's GPA before I give them a grade?
So let me try answering the question a different way. We were not involved in vetting the FERPA properties of the application. It was CUNY Central that did. So this has been looked at by lawyers and CIS, et cetera. And this is, you know, yet one more tool in our toolkit that gives us access for sure to student information that we need to curate and be very, very careful with. That is, when I look at a student's profile, I should be looking at that student's profile only with respect to a job function that I have, and not for other purposes. Being a member of the faculty, I have that access privileged, and it is part of my job to keep that information under good protection.
I'll also chime in and say that different users have different what are called roles in the system. So they have access to different parts of the functionality that that this Navigate system offers. So the kind of information that one can see can be limited based on what role you have. But we consider all of our full-time faculty members to be advisors or potential advisors. So having the need to access this information about the students they're going to serve, it really helps for us to enhance the what is called like the coordinated care network, so that we're all working to help support students, and the more information we have and can coordinate on, coordinate with, the better. Just so you know that when faculty and staff come for training on this, we do address FERPA issues, which really ought to be addressed when anyone is given access to any information that has FERPA protected data on our students. As Eva said, access to that information should be for designated work purposes, and people are reminded about how to keep that information secure, not downloading it to places that other people can access.
May I ask a question?
Absolutely, and I also see that Jeffrey Greenberg has his hand up, and I'll see if others do. Please, Renee.
Oh, thank you. You know, I've had a little bit of experience with QC Navigate out of concern over a fair number of students in my two undergraduate classes who are just not there. And as it is, I've tried, you know, I did have a problem initially because I just adopted for this semester a Google Classroom. And so some students were checking Blackboard to see where I was. And so I saw that. But until I realized that, you know, I was sending them messages through CUNY First, right? So we have CUNY First, we have Blackboard, we have Google Classroom, and QC Navigate. And it just seems tough to know what should take precedence, right? And so I did make a few reports into QC Navigate out of concern for where are they? You know, either some just came and disappeared, or, you know, there's no particular pattern. And sometimes I do ask students, look, you know, I don't expect you to tell me, you know, things that might be personal, but how about, you know, through QC Navigate, a professional can, from the college, can be in touch with you to help. And they, oh, no, I don't want to do that. So I'm not quite sure what to do.
So if I could say, I mean, we're... It's hard to know what to recommend, and I don't think there's a single answer for because this is all complicated. I recently had a colleague tell me, you know, I have two students who have just disappeared. They have failed to do assignments, et cetera, et cetera. I said, why don't you submit alerts through Navigate for them? That way their advisor will be notified, and maybe that will shake them up a little bit. And he wrote to me the following day saying that he actually just went ahead and talked to his students, and now they're actually doing the assignments. So sometimes just having...
Well, I always try, yeah.
You know, yeah. We are still at a stage, though, where we're having a lot of internal conversations in both in the offices that I oversee that are using alerts, as well as in the Navigate implementation team more writ large. And this is one of the reasons that we wanted to come to the Senate with respect to, should we be developing better college-wide practices around these, now that we've got data that can help us, that can help inform our thinking in terms of whether if we use this aspect of the tool, what does it do, and is it worth doing it, and or should we be doing something else? But also in terms of working with each other around what does it really mean to be a community that provides care and support to our students in order to engage them in successfully completing their degrees.
Right.
May I ask a question, Ava?
I think that Jeffrey was waiting. Jeffrey,
I'm sorry, yes.
Hi, I have two quick questions. One is slightly related to what was just asked. Obviously, the back end of QC Navigate must be tied in to the information in CUNY First. Is it also, or can it be tied in as well to Blackboard so that it will show students upcoming assignments that are due, access to Grade Center, important information that may have been uploaded to Blackboard? And my second question is, if I am trying to email my class, I know that if I send it through Blackboard, everyone on the class gets it at some email address anyway. If I email them through QC Navigate, does everybody get it, or only the students who have downloaded that app?
So two great questions. The first one, unfortunately, no, not the version of QC of Navigate that CUNY got for the university. But maybe that will be something. And it goes back to a comment that Renee made earlier about, you know, there's all these platforms, they should all be talking to each other. And a lot of the work that we've been doing, frankly, as a function of implementing this application, has been advocating with CUNY Central for getting better connections between the tools and smoother data, right? And so as far as your second question, and so first of all, no, students don't need to have Navigate in order for them to get messages that you send them through Navigate. And that's the two platforms thing. The app is sort of a good add-on, but in order for you as a professor and advisor to interact with students using Navigate staff, they don't need to download the app. The application has data about email and cell number that comes from CUNY First. So whatever CUNY First has as preferred email address is where your emails will be going. And so this is probably more than Chair Yearwood is, more time than Chair Yearwood is probably willing to give us, but we have tried to do a lot of work on that front in order to get to get the data and they're cleaned up. The same for cell phone numbers. If you text students, it will go to whatever it says is a cell phone number in CUNY First. And we've looked and seen that sometimes the numbers that are that appear as cell phone numbers are not cell phone numbers. So if you send texts to students and the cell number is not working, it appears as an email from you in their inbox.
Thank you. We'll end this with Alan. You can take the last.
I'll pass. I'll contact Ava separately. No problem.
Okay.
I just have a quick question that came up. I sent a student I was advising their advisement sheet that showed, you know, what courses I would suggest taking, but neither one of us could ever find it anywhere in Navigate. So I know it uploaded in Navigate, but they never could find where it was for them to see.
Would you put your name in the chat and maybe we can have an offline conversation about that? We'll see if we can find what happened to that. Absolutely. Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. And any questions, again, you can reach out directly. We're going to move on to item 3B, memorial for Harry Hohen.
Yes, thank you so much, Simone. I am Ray Frederick from the Department of Family, Nutrition and Exercise Sciences. And I would just like to take a moment on behalf of our chair, Ashima Kant, Dr. Kant, and the rest of the department to have a memorial message for an esteemed colleague, Dr. Harry Hohen, who recently passed away. It is with deep sadness that I announce the passing of our colleague, Dr. Harry Hohen, on October 20th from complications from a fall in his home. Dr. Hohen served the department continuously for 63 years as an associate professor and a member of the Department of Family Nutrition and Exercise Sciences, formerly the Department of Health and Physical Education. Harry was hired in 1957 to support the 3-credit basic skills program of physical education, which was required of all students graduating from Queens College. With the specialty in outdoor education, Dr. Hohen contributed by teaching courses in sailing, scuba diving, skiing, and wilderness skills, and led trips within the United States as well as to the Caribbean, Canada, and Europe. He was committed and a dedicated teacher who provided excellent service to the college. Admired by his students, he provided valuable life experiences to those coming from Queens and the surrounding areas. He was known as Doc to his students and colleagues in the department, and he will be fondly remembered by his many friends and former students. Dr. Hohen was predeceased by his wife and 2 sons. Recently, a memorial was held on Rockaway Beach in remembrance of Dr. Hohen. So thank you on behalf of the department for Dr. Hohen's memorial.
We'd like to take a brief moment of silence in his memory. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other announcements? Okay, I'd like to make one on behalf of Rosenthal Library, that the library will be reopening for student study space beginning Monday, November 30th through Monday, December 21st, which is the last day of finals. It'll be Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Notices will go out and the reservation link will be placed on the library's webpage beginning the week of November 23rd. Any other announcements?
Oh, I have an announcement if
yes,
I have a moment. I wanted to announce the Department of Drama, Theater, and Dance is going to be presenting 2 productions in December. They're going to be streaming, The first one is called Scenes from a Quarantine, which will be directed by Claudia Feldstein. And that's going to be December 10th through 12th at 7 p.m. and December 13th at 3 p.m. You do need tickets, which will be available on the Kupferberg Center website. So if you go to kupferbergcenter.org or call them at 718-793-8080, you should be able to get tickets. Tickets are free for QC students and $5 for everybody else. We're also going to be doing our annual dance concert that's normally performed in the Goldstein Theater. It will be streamed on December 3rd through the 5th at 7 and December 6th at 3. Same prices and same way to get tickets. That's all.
Thank you. Any other announcements? Okay. And I wanted to open the floor to President Wu, who did want to make a brief statement on the strategic planning, if he is still interested.
Yes. Hi. Okay. I'll be very brief. I just wanted to thank the Senate for who you recommended. As you know, strategic planning has started. Please come to one of the town halls, and we are trying to involve everyone. That's why we turned to the Senate to suggest names of professors. We went to the student leadership for names of students and the PNB for names of chairs. And then we asked that the co-chairs be elected from among faculty. So every working group has a faculty co-chair, and every group has a student member. So I just wanted you to know that we appreciate your input. We intend to continue to receive that input. And I'm so pleased that we have the two speakers. I think Simone will say a few words about them, but we really want to offer people insight into the diversity of the borough. This is starting a series, and I want to thank you for welcoming them. I have to apologize to them. I should have worked more closely with Simone to give you a later start time, but your joining the entirety of the Senate meeting gives you insight into how the Senate works, which is good. So thank you, Simone. That's all I have. It's just a message of gratitude, and we'll see you at the strategic planning town halls. Thanks.
Thank you. And I would also like to make the announcement that we are, I'm going to use this word, and maybe it'll appease some of you, that we are still anxiously looking for full-time faculty to serve on the Student Faculty Disciplinary Committee. Those of you who are interested, please reach out to myself or Brenda, and we can get that up and going. We have a low, we're not meeting the status for faculty representation on that particular committee.
And that's a joint ask from the two of us. Thank you.
Thank you. So any other announcements? Okay, perfect. Seeing none, I'd like to move on to agenda item number 5, committee reports, beginning with the undergraduate curriculum committee minutes dated October 8th. Dr. Lord?
Yes, I'd like to move the minutes of October 8th from the undergraduate curriculum committee and ask for unanimous consent.
Point of information?
Yes.
With respect to number 6, the finesse proposed major in food management studies, is my memory correct? I mean, I've been through this before many years ago, that we're not actually approving this new major. We're giving them permission to develop the new major.
The major's been changed. All we're doing is we neglected to change the title of the major.
Am I correct that a new major needs a new HEGIS code? This is no longer a concentration, it's a major.
That would be true. It's my recollection that it's all been taken care of except for the name of the major.
Okay, I may have missed that the Senate approved that at some point in the past.
I believe so.
Okay, I was not on the Senate. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Yes, if there's any objections.
Any objections to moving a unanimous consent?
I'd
adopted. Thank you, Dr. Lord.
Thank you.
The nominating committee report dated November 12th. Is it November 12th or November 10th? Brenda, can you confirm that? I know we
have November 10th.
November 10th. So that would have to be item 5B is the report dated November 10th. Dr. Wang had to go to a class. So she's asking for unanimous consent on accepting the nominating committee report dated November 10th.
Any objections?
Any objections? Okay, so moved. Thank you. 5C, the elections committee report, Professor Suru.
Good afternoon. I ask the Senate for unanimous consent to accept the report of 10-14-21 as presented.
That's 10-14-20.
My apologies, 10-14-20.
Objections.
Any objections? Okay, so moved. Thank you. Old business, 6A, nominations to the nominating committee. We are still looking for faculty on nominations for faculty in the social sciences. Any nominations? Okay, seeing none. Faculty in the arts and humanities, nominations. Thank you. New business. As President Wu noted a moment ago, we will be starting to have these mini Queen's diversity presentations that will allow faculty to present findings on racial issues. And today we are pleased to announce that we have Dr. Flowers and Dr. Pierre Louis that will be giving a brief presentation. Unfortunately, I have too many screens open, so it's going to be really difficult to pull up your bio. So if you could share with us your department, and then you can begin. You have presentation privileges if you'd like to share your screen. Dr. Flowers. Yes, he's trying to find the unmute.
Okay. I always forget to unmute. Let's see here. 1 second. Can you guys see my entire screen?
It's not in presentation mode, but yes, we can see your screen. Okay. And would you please remember to just share your department information?
Okay. Let's see. I can get this. Let's see. I am in the history department, and my name is Deidre Flowers, and I am in the history department. I am also the interim chair for Africana Studies for the 2021 academic year, and I'm still trying to get my screen correct. Okay. So I'm ready. They fled as if under a spell or a high fever. They left as though they were fleeing from some curse. They were willing to make almost any sacrifice to obtain a railroad ticket, and they left with the intention of staying. From the early years of the 20th century to well past its middle age, nearly every Black family in the American South, that is almost every Black family in America, had a decision to make. There were sharecroppers losing at settlement, typists wanting to work in an office, yard boys scared that a single gesture near the planter's wife could leave them hanging from an oak tree. They were all stuck in a caste system as hard and unyielding as the red Georgia clay, and they each had a decision before them. In this, they were unlike anyone who ever longed to cross the Atlantic or the Rio Grande. It was during the First World War that a silent pilgrimage took its first steps within the borders of this country. The first rose without warning or notice or much in the way of understanding by those outside its reach. It would not end until the 1970s and would set in motion changes in the North and South that no one, not even the people doing the leaving, could have imagined at the start of or dreamed would take nearly a lifetime to play out. Historians have come to call it the Great Migration. It would become perhaps the biggest underreported story of the 20th century. It was vast, it was leaderless, it crept along so many thousands of currents over so long a stretch of time as to be difficult for the press truly to capture it while it was underway. Over the course of six decades, some 6 million Black Southerners left the land of their forefathers and fanned out across the country for an uncertain existence in nearly every other corner of America. The Great Migration became a turning point in history. It would transform urban America and recast the social and political order of every city it touched. It would force the South to search its soul and finally to lay aside a feudal caste system. It grew out of the unmet promises made after the Civil War, and through the sheer weight of it, helped push the country toward the civil rights revolutions of the 1960s. Good afternoon, I'm Deidre Flowers. good afternoon, members of the Queens College Senate. I am Deidre Flowers, substitute assistant professor in the history department and interim director of the Africana Studies program. Today, I am here to speak with you about the Great Migration. The words I just read for you are Isabel Wilkerson's words. They can be found in her Pulitzer Prize winning book, The Warmth of Other Suns, in which she traces the lives of several Southerners who escaped the grasp of Jim Crow's chokehold on their lives and sought the freedom and choices America offers to its citizens, theoretically, all of them. The map that you see here now is a graphic display of the migration of African Americans out of the South. In both phases of the Great Migration, the first being 1910 to roughly 1939 or 1940, and the second between 1940 as Europe was entering World War II to 1970. The first Great Migration was characterized by movement north. You can see, hopefully you can see my cursor. You see the darker colors coming out of the South and going north more on the eastern side of the country. And the second Great Migration was characterized by moving west. So you see the arrows coming out of the South and lighter, it's a lighter color going over to more to the West Coast. The next slide shows panel one of Jacob Lawrence's Great Migration series. He is an artist, and in this collection, there's actually 61 images, and the Museum of Modern Art back in 2015 had an entire exhibit devoted to reuniting the majority of the pieces in this work and brought together other pieces of art, whether it was literature or music artists, to bring life to what this is. If you have an opportunity, there is a book that's available. I checked it on Amazon. I'm not sure if it's the book that goes along with the exhibit, but it shows you all of the different panels of this Great Migration series. And it's a depiction of what African Americans endured in the South and what they endured as they transitioned from the South to the North. My next two slides offer a snapshot of over a century of population growth of African Americans in New York City, numerically and graphically. The city's population was slightly under 100,000 in 1910 when county level census data became available, and by 1970 exceeded 1.5 million. During that same time, Queens County, there are five counties in New York City, also known as the boroughs, but Queens County's African-American population increased by more than 250,000. The graphic showing population growth by borough reveals that by 1970, the end of the Great Migration, Queens followed Brooklyn, Manhattan, and the Bronx in numbers of African-Americans populating the boroughs. Queens has been, I'm way more familiar with Harlem, I'm from Harlem, but what I can say that I found in my research is that Queens has been and is home to a number of well-known African-Americans. Most of those associated with the Great Migration or settling in Queens were musicians, and they included Count Basie, Louis Armstrong, Clarence Williams, Barry Galbraith, Dizzy Gillespie, Ella Fitzgerald, Clark Terry, Cannonball Adderley, James Johnson, Fess Williams, Fats Waller, Mercer Ellington, that's Duke Ellington's son, Lena Horne, and Benny Waters. And there were other well-known African-Americans whose family exited the South during the Great Migration. This is a list of people that you will recognize as well. Richard Wright, Bill Russell, John Coltrane, Zora Neale Hurston, Miles Davis, Ralph Ellison, Toni Morrison, August Wilson, Jacob Lawrence, who we've seen his images, Diana Ross, Tupac Shakur, Prince, Michael Jackson, Shonda Rhimes, Venus and Serena Williams, Emmett Till, Tamir Rice, Jackie Robinson, James Earl Jones, Muddy Waters, Denzel Washington, Romare Bearden, Whitney Houston, Sarah Vaughan, Althea Gibson, Diane Carroll, Lorraine Hansberry, Malcolm X, Huey Newton, and last name that I found was Ella Baker. And as I thought about this, and I'm going to share my last slide. My last slide is books that are related to the Great Migration. There's one article there. I have a whole section on Harlem because I'm from Harlem. But what I will say to you is, if you're interested in the Great Migration and you want to read more deeply, you should read Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns. Came out in 2010. I read it last summer. It made me rethink how I ended up in New York. My mother came at the tail end of the Great Migration, and that is how someone like me ends up as a first generation college student with a PhD and somehow at Queens College teaching history. She's got also, I'm looking for the other Isabel Wilkerson book. It should be on here. Cast, which is a more recent book. I think, for some reason, I think I didn't put it on here. But Cast is her more recent book, where she actually compares the race issue in the United States with Nazi Germany and with the caste system in India. Things that I may never have put together, but she put them together masterfully in her most recent book, which came out this year. You can also see Kenesha Grant. She writes about the Great Migration and the Democratic Party. And Marcia Chatillon, I think I'm saying her name correctly. She wrote about Southside Girls growing up during the Great Migration. And I think that her book focuses on one of the more Western states. I have not read it fully, but I have used it in my research. Some of the books that are listed under Harlem are more commonly known, of course, James Weldon Johnson and Black Manhattan, Gilbert Osofsky, Harlem, The Making of a Ghetto, David Levering Lewis, When Harlem Was in Vogue, and a more recent work by Shannon King called Whose Harlem Is This Anyway? Community Politics and Activism During the New Negro Era. And then there were two more books on New York City. One that I recently read, it's on LaShawn Harris, and she talks about some of the other boroughs, but it's called Sex Workers, Psychics, and Number Runners. And in it, she talks about people moving to New York City and specifically in Harlem, but she touches on the other boroughs. And the last book is from 2000. It's from the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, and it's called Black New Yorkers, 400 Years of African-American History. That concludes my presentation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Flowers. Dr. Pierre-Louis?
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, President Wu and President Simone Yearwood and members of the Senate for inviting me to present on the Haitian community in America and primarily in Queens. I am François Pierre-Louis, Professor of Political Science. I've been at Queens College since 1997. And, you know, I was a member of the Senate a few years ago. So it's always a good pleasure to be among you. To be brief, let me start by saying that the Haitian community, or Haiti itself, has had a long-term relationship with the United States. Haitian slaves fought in Savannah, Georgia, for the American Revolution. Mm. In fact, some of those people who fought in Savannah, they're the ones who went back to Haiti to fight in the revolution. So recently there was this statue of that was erected in Savannah showing the Haitian slaves who were part of the fight for the revolution. But unfortunately, our relationship with the US was never a very good, in the sense that not only we fought for the US independence, but Jefferson was the one who advocated not to have any relationship with Haiti, saying that, you know, they couldn't conceive us seeing a Black Republic and having relationship with Blacks. So Haiti was excluded from everything when it comes to international relations or commerce and diplomatic relations with the US. It wasn't until the 1860s that diplomatic relations were established. And in Haiti, because of the Monroe Doctrine that was established in the US, seeing Haiti and the rest of the Caribbean and Latin America as the US backyard, in 1915, the US occupied Haiti and stayed there until 1934. During the Duvalier period, we had a long-term relationship where the American government supported Duvalier. As a result of that, it created havoc in Haiti. And a lot of people took the seas to come to Miami, to the shores to seek asylum. And the US, the American government basically refused to provide them asylum and put them in jail, Guantanamo Bay, in Brooklyn, other parts in Florida. And a lot of people had to mobilize in order to get to seek asylum for the Haitian refugees who were in jail. And this all continued. And right now, I think the US is the only, Haiti is the only country that the US forced it to sign a treaty where Haitians can be stopped at seas and returned back to Haiti instead of being granted political asylum. Despite all this, we happen to have a thriving Haitian community anyway in America and in New York City. For example, Haitians began to arrive in mass beginning in the 1960s during the Duvalier repression. In 1960, there were about 4,800 Haitians that came in officially based on the census. By the 1980, we had about 92,000. Today, we have over 700,000 Haitians living in the United States. In New York State itself, there's about 165,000. In New York City, we have about 118,000 living in New York City. Now, granted that all these are the official numbers from the census and from homeland, but however, there are others who may be overstaying their visa, who live in the community, but we don't, that are not mentioned. The Haitians in New York City, in Brooklyn, for example, has the largest number of Haitians, about 61,000. And in the 1970s and 80s, as Queens neighborhoods began to, whites began to move to Long Island, to other parts, a lot of housing came that were previously restricted to Haitians and to African Americans and Black people came to open, and Haitians moved from Brooklyn to Queens. So therefore, that's why there's a vibrant Haitian community in Queens, primarily in Cambria Heights, in Loyalton, in Jamaica, St. Albans, and different other places. In fact, about 27% of Haitian immigrants in the city live in Queens, and most of them are concentrated in the southeastern part of Queens. Moreover, in terms of the socioeconomic status of the Haitians, it shows that one of the interesting things about the Haitian community, it's very young, or it used to be in many ways at the beginning. Most of them are less than 25 years old and wanted to live in their own home, and more than half are in the labor force. In fact, the median income of Haitians in New York is about $38,000, which is higher than the average. And the reason for that is because a lot of the Haitians are in the healthcare sector. So sometimes, they own a home, but you have two or three people in the house who are working as nurses. We have a lot of Haitian professionals as doctors also. So therefore, that's where they are, that's where the income is very high in that way. More than 45% of the Haitian immigrants had a high school diploma or a higher degree. So that also creates opportunities for those that have a high school education. And there's a large participation of Haitian women in the labor force, because usually when the Haitian people migrate, the women come in first and then they send out for the men, after that. So these are the numbers that we have in Queens based on the census. Hill, Briarwood, Fresh Meadow, Hillcrest, we have about 2,000, Jamaica, 10,000, Far Rockaway, 2,000, Queens Village, Cambria Heights, about 19,000. So there are also Haitian community organizations in Queens, social organizations that provide help with housing, healthcare, unemployment, issues of labor work. So some of the challenges that Haitian immigrants are facing in Queens began primarily not only it started a long time ago, but it got exacerbated with the Trump administration. First, that began to reduce the number of increase the number of years for Haitian immigrants to send in for their loved ones. Right now, it's about 15 years it will take for a family to be reunited from Haiti, whereas years ago it used to be 5 and 9 years. TPS, after the earthquake in 2010 and previously during the coup that happened, the US provided a temporary protecting status to about 50,000 Haitians. Now, many of these Haitians are working and they're the ones who send money to Haiti. Not only the Trump administration had threatened to cut the TPS, but to return those Haitians back home. And the Dreamer was also a Haitian, young Haitian who came here when they were young. The Trump administration had also threatened to cut these things. Now, what has happened is that if in the 1980s, Haitians were being stigmatized for HIV carriers, they were being treated badly. A lot of Haitians were not even proud of admitting that they were Haitians. By the 1990s, that had changed a lot. One of the reasons that changed is because more and more Haitians became citizens. They began to run for political offices, because right now in the city council, we have two Haitians Americans that we never had before. We have legislators from Albany, and even Washington DC, Mia Love, who was elected to the US Congress from Utah, is a Haitian American of descent. And right now, one of the things we've seen also from the Department of Homeland Security is that in 2010, there were 12,000 Haitians that became naturalized, whereas in 2012, it jumped to 19,000. And that means the Haitians are beginning to realize that they need to participate in the political process in order to make changes. It is refreshing to know that two of the major advisors to Biden and Harris, Karine Andre and Karine Jean-Pierre, are Haitian Americans. And there are many more also that are working with the Biden administration. So in conclusion, I would say that there is a younger generation of Haitian Americans that is emerging in New York and the rest of the country. These young people are active in all sectors of American life and they are empowering the community. For example, Haitian American singer like Wyclef Jean, which really popularized Haiti and the Haitian community by carrying, wearing the Haitian flag every time he sings. We have elected officials, various politicians in the suburbs. For example, if you live on Long Island in Valley Stream or Elmont, you heard of Carrie Solage. And also we have writers like Ibrish Dantikat, Roxane Gay. These people did not really deny that they were Haitians, and they began to change the narrative about Haitians in the United States. They are not really embarrassed to speak Creole and to celebrate the Haitian flag and to promote Haiti. So I would say, despite President Trump's unwelcoming comments about Haiti and Haitian Americans in the past, I'm sure that the community in New York and the rest of America is definitely here to stay and will thrive. So this is a very short version of a lot of other things I could have mentioned, just to give you, a slight, presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. We will definitely make these slides available to you. Again, thank you so much. I'd like to move on to our last official agenda item, and that was the newly minted item 7B, land acknowledgements. Dr. Lowry?
Thanks very much. I joined Queens College in January this year, and I think this is my second Senate meeting. And I've noticed that a lot of US universities make land acknowledgements at the beginning of some of their public meetings or their high level meetings, and that we don't do that at Queens. And so really what I wanted to say was more of a question: is there a protocol for doing land acknowledgements at Queens College, and should there be? And is that something that actually the Faculty Senate would ordinarily deal with?
What is a land acknowledgement?
Yes, that's what I was going to ask. What exactly is a land acknowledgement?
So it's a short statement that acknowledges that the land that we're meeting on is unceded, belonging to the traditional owners. And it's a way of acknowledging that we are operating in an environment that's still characterized by colonialism.
So I would imagine, and this is just me talking out loud, is that something similar to a resolution on behalf of the Senate, Dave? I'm looking at you.
Unnecessary.
It's unnecessary, you said?
Right. I mean, we can pass anything, but I mean, there's no legal requirements here.
Right. So I don't know how to answer exactly. You can make any statement that you so choose.
Simone, yes. This is Richard Alvarez.
Hi, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. And I guess the question, it is something that happens often. And I think, and I may be wrong, but New York City, because it was, I think New York City is one of the few cities that actually the acquisition of the land was through a business transaction, not through kind of conquering, that it may just change, because it is not something that within, at least in my 40 plus years in the city, that has been a practice, but it's something that we could certainly explore. But I think it has to do with how New York City became New York City versus how other places around the country was not the case.
Okay. And there is a link that was put into the chat by Kevin Ferguson, more on land acknowledgements.
Could I comment on what was just said? I don't think New York City's land was acquired through business transactions between, you know, equals. I think, you know, you did have colonial powers. They strong-armed and the Native Americans, and the Native Americans didn't really know what they were signing up for when they were deeding land away. So I don't think that's at all historically accurate in terms of how the land was acquired in New York City. From the Native Americans, at least, from the initial, you know, Dutch and English acquisitions.
Simone, maybe the executive committee should discuss this and bring something to the next meeting.
So Dr. Harry, if you'd like to post a statement, can you send me an email? The executive committee meets next week and we'll make sure to add this as an agenda item.
Thanks, I'll do that.
Thank you. And thank you, everyone. That's the end of our meeting. I just like with the start of the holiday season approaching and us not meeting until December, I'd just like to wish everyone healthy, happy, safe holiday. And again, thank you to all the presenters. It was fantastic. We've learned so much. And I have some reading to do. So thank you, Dr. Flowers. Everything was wonderful. So again, thank you. Be well, everyone, and stay safe. Motion to adjourn. I just need one of you.
So moved.
Second.
So moved. Meeting officially adjourned. 4:50 p.m. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Bye bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.